I'll just give what I was going to say at the very end, that in addition to Feed the Future, Partnering for Innovation, and our support for various other initiatives like Tom's Initiative for Smallholder Finance, the Bureau for Food Security's Office of Market and Partnerships Innovation has also recently launched a new investment support program that will be implemented by Dahlberg's Global Development Advisors. It's a 5-year program with a $60 million ceiling that is focused on technical assistance and advisory services to mobilize private sector capital towards opportunities that can generate both economic and social impact. It works within the agricultural sector, but has the opportunity to work outside the agricultural sector as well. It's a market-driven approach, and it will provide such services as investment identification and promotion, investment facilitation, including negotiation of business-to-business value chain partnerships, and deepening financial sector engagement in developing markets. Elizabeth Diebolt is on the webinar and will include some more information on how to follow up with her specifically on the investment support program. She is a USAID manager. And if you have any, for the people in the room, please feel free to come up to me after the webinar if you'd like more specifics. But I imagine this just began earlier this month, so I imagine in the next month or two you will start seeing more information. But this is just one other way that our office is trying to engage in this increasingly important sector in international development, with engaging the private sector and finding strategic ways to de-risk their investment. Do we have Louisa back yet, or should we move on to Q&A? Okay, so I'm going to pass the mic over to Julie.
Great. Thank you so much, Laura, and thank you very much to our speakers. And if we get Louisa back, we'll see if we can patch her in. But we have about 25 minutes or so for Q&A with our speakers. So we'll go ahead and move into that. And I also, just before we start Q&A, wanted to ask that if you have the opportunity to fill out the survey on your chairs, that's always very helpful for us to help improve our events going forward. If you have to leave early, just feel free to leave it on your chair or drop it on the front table outside. And traditionally, we start with a question from our online audience. So I'll throw it back to our webinar team in the back and see if they have the first question.
Yes, and there are 180 people joining us online from all over the world, so thanks for tossing it to the webinar audience. The first question is from Alexis Giannotis, and I'm sorry, I'm probably mispronouncing that. Can you expand on your point of effective customer segmentation? What do you think about segmenting, e.g. crop, productivity, and behavioral, and how is that applied in thinking of customized approaches? That was a question for Robert.
Of course. I think that Louisa spoke to this a little bit, I think Tom did as well. Smallholder farmers are not just one massive market. There are different ways of segmenting the market to tailor your products and services uniquely to their needs. And the better you understand those needs, either by applying different methodologies from ethnographic research to others, the better you're able to be successful in those markets. So it could be everything from segmenting, based on geographic region, segmenting based on rain-fed or non-rain-fed regions, segmenting based on degree of land size, plot size. There are a number of different ways to cut that fruit, as the visual suggested. And I think the point really is that it's about segmentation that will drive the types of successes you can have. And maybe I think Tom can speak to that in the context of finance as well.
Yes, certainly. And part of the work that we've done, actually, we particularly as it relates to direct farmer, we're using C-gap segmentation. That's pretty rudimentary segmentation, because the theory being there is a whole class, I think, as Luis referred to them as emerging farmers, who are actually pretty well served in terms of their financial need. These include some of the export cash crop smallholders that are actually, and those who have larger than the standard 2-hectare plots. So again, beginning to think, along a number of different dimensions, who is it that you're targeting, and what behavior you're trying to affect, One thing I'd call your attention to, prior to my life focusing on agricultural to financial services for this community, I did actually, what I did at Dahlberg was help develop and grow their agricultural practice. We did a project with the Gates Foundation 3 or 4 years ago called Farmer Focus, and it was a very comprehensive national level survey of two different countries, one in Malawi, one in Tanzania. And the idea was, is there a way to come up with a replicable customer segmentation so you can think about who you're approaching? And so I think they did somewhere around 7,000 primary interviews. And it was along what you had talked about in the question, Alexis. Both demographic information, but also there was and we called it a skill well matrix. There was a huge behavioral element to it. And there's a really interesting data set that's available through that work. And it gets to how do you really need to think about those that you're targeting with goods and services. The good news was that we did it in two countries to see if there was compatibility, and there were two very different contexts. And from at least a statistical perspective, the consumer segments held. And so there are types that you can see within the market that fall out along this skill well matrix. And it does help with targeting.
Do we have a question from our in-person audience? I'll come over here. In general, please state your name and organization, if that's all right. Thank you.
Chris McRae, Value True. Last week I was at Georgetown where the Secretary for Agriculture directly launched Rural Entrepreneurship Program with the Global Social Value Enterprise Group within Georgetown. And I was wondering, do you have a space for basically exchanging your models internationally and inside the country? Because it seems to be so much commonality. Also, it would be jolly useful if that could include 20 to 30-year-olds, because there are not many 20 to 30-year-olds in this room. And so generally, how do you share all of these models across these cross-connected interest groups?
That's a great question, and I think fortunately Partnering for Innovation has what's called the AgTech Exchange, where we'll actually bring to life the models guide by webifying it, in terms of not just having it be a PDF document, but a community around which other people can add their models. And we also are integrating a lot of additional resources and information of where we got our own research from in terms of where existing case studies exist. And the idea that over time we can have virtual community discussions and webinars that can start to increase that body of knowledge, because I agree with you, it's often fragmented out there. And the idea is to try to bring as many of them together either through that platform or through AgriLinks and others as well. But totally agree with that concept.
We had an interesting happenstance. One of our program officers from the Skoll Foundation relayed a story that they had been at a meeting. It was a conference after a meeting with the San Francisco Fed, and the San Francisco Fed is actually responsible for administering the Community Redevelopment Act requirements of the local banking community. And they were looking at smallholder farmers in Northern California, and somehow they had gotten a hold of our report and were using the five growth pathways, but in the context of the Northern California farmers. And that, honestly, was not an idea that had dawned on us at the time, because we'd been more focused on the emerging markets. But the idea for these models walking across different geographies, or irrespective of whether they're emerging and global, I think it's a very important one.
All right, we'll toss it back to our online audience, and I'll get you next.
This question comes from Josimo Rocha of ADRA International, and I agree that getting the business model right is essential, but to what extent should donor projects take the role in closing the gap so smallholders are more business-oriented? Should we just leave it to the private sector to help them?
I think that's also a very good question, and the notion of what role should a donor play is always a very important question that donors are thinking about. How far is too far? Are they subsidizing too much? And where can the private sector really engage with their own resources? And it's a fine balance. I don't think there's a perfect answer. I think different donors will look at this issue of how to de-risk and how to subsidize in different ways. But I think many of the newer developments in donor communities is about leveraging. and actually ensuring that the companies put their own skin in the game. And that is a way of trying to say, look, we're in this together. We're not, it's not just here to help you and provide you with all the subsidy to cover all of your additional costs that would require you to enter this marketplace. So I think it's about finding that right balance, and I think that at least the later developments in development finance have been moving in that direction and looking at more effective leveraging schemes.
Kind of further it and say, I think kind of the next generation of what's happening, at least in the financial services community, there needs to be some thought given to how do you move the incentives for participation closer to those who have immediate interest in what's happening with that local smallholder farmer community. And that includes both the multinational corporation, or even if it's not multinational, you know, a regional player within the supply chain, but also the local government. And there's a big, you know, kind of a follow-on open question, and something that needs to be resolved is, what is the role of the policy environment, and again, setting up the right context for this, and any sort of subsidy regime longer term. We did a piece looking back at, it was a historical comparative analysis of the U.S., South Korea, and Germany. One of the reasons we did this piece is because I had no reference point. I was like, what's this supposed to look like if we get it developed? Or are we in such a different world now that it's going to be completely different no matter what? And the interesting thing is, and I think this is no surprise to the people in the room, in each of those markets, subsidy and policy support never went away for this particular part of the market. And so one thing that needs to be brought into this discussion is, what does that advocacy agenda look like locally, but what are the right policy structures and or subsidies that are required to have effective commercial participation, particularly around the financial service community?
A question from our in-person audience.
Thank you so much. My name is Anita Campion. I'm with Conexus Corporation. We organize the annual Cracking the Nut Conference. Our next year's event is going to focus on addressing challenges amid climate change to expanding rural and agricultural markets. So I'm curious to know from both of you of kind of what you see as the likely implications as climate change is making things even more difficult for predicting agricultural markets. And, you know, one thought I have was, say, you know, should we be looking at ways to leverage the playing field for agribusinesses to other businesses by providing, say, public insurance that would cover, you know, index-based insurance, for example? Or, you know, do you have any other thoughts on kind of from your own, your wealth of experience on that?
That was a puppy.
So we are exposed on what are the effects of climate change on financial service provision to smallholders. We haven't looked hard enough at it, I'll just be completely honest. And in fact, I was talking to Doug Pond from Opportunity International about being on a panel at your conference, and I said, I think that Dahlberg could go deeper on this than the Initiative for Smallholder Finance could at this stage. Obviously, there are huge implications for how financial service providers are going to need to think about risk. I do think there is a potential role for sponsored or subsidized insurance products. I'm not sure that there is anybody to step up and do that at scale at this point, but it is something that we need to go further into and think about. Obviously, the effects on the financial service world are not just around the risk of their loans, their own risk assessment. Obviously, there are much broader impacts that we need to think about in terms of what is the impact on the smallholder community outside of what might worry a bank or a financial institution.
Yeah, there are two answers to that. I think part of it is also, you know, looking at climate-smart agriculture and what are practices that can really ensure certain degrees of resilience for smallholders and what that might mean and what that implies in terms of education and awareness raising for the smallholder community. And of course, on the other side is the issue of how do you figure out what's the right insurance scheme that can look at those issues more holistically, as you suggest. And it may be about, you know, bundling private, public, and looking at other incentive schemes that can try to address that issue. But I would agree that there isn't yet the proverbial solution that can really be at scale, I think, in the market as of yet.
One caveat, though, and actually I'm now recalling the conversation with Doug. Some of the same concepts, and this is both from an agronomic practice perspective, but also from a financial service perspective,
that have been talked about in the context of just creating a more efficient business model actually have knock-on benefits for when you think about that in the context of climate change. So I think there needs to be just a shift of the lens to say, okay, we've been thinking about things like tillage and some of the other productivity enhancements, thinking about them in the context of how does that increase productivity at a lower cost longer term, and then how do you finance the materials that we require to do some of those practices, thinking about it as a long-term business model efficiency play rather than there's a climate change play here. And I just, you know, we have not done the work to do that, to line it up and say this is what's going to be effective here and this is the implications of it.
I just wanted to add quickly that our office has separate initiatives, and one of our Feed the Future Innovation Lab specifically works on weather-based index insurance pilots and working through the difficulties of measuring basis risk to get quality insurance products for smallholder farmers that do protect them from risk. We've also recently partnered with the World Bank, which is starting to pull together a field of experts to think through some of these challenges moving forward. There are several private sector index-based insurance providers that are beginning to saturate some of the smallholder market, but there's still more work that needs to be done in structuring high-quality index insurance products for smallholders.
All right, we'll toss it back to our online audience and then come back to the in-person room.
Thank you. This question comes from Steve Lynn, an independent consultant in Brattleboro, Vermont. Since farmers' ability to afford financial services is directly related to their markets, can you speak about tying financial service provision to market outlets?
I'm not 100% sure that I understand the question, to market outlets. And I'm not sure if the distinction that we're making here is between tight value chains and loose value chains. And hopefully I'm answering this question most successfully, or most accurately, and also successfully. Most of what's happened in the smallholder finance community thus far has actually been where there is a direct tethering to buyers and market outlets. And that's largely what's been financed, regardless of whether it's at the cooperative level or actually you're going down to the direct-to-farmer model, which is the trade finance is actually run off of the buyer's note, and that's kind of the cap on the receivable. And that's been more successful in export cash crops where there's a more predictable buying market and the margins are better. I think what we're seeing, the second part of that would be the market outlets and the ones that are of more interest for the smallholder community, as the bulk of the smallholder community, would be those market outlets that are locally or regionally based. And I think that's where our work is moving toward, which is how do you think about the financial service provision in the context of these local commercial cash crops that are not export cash crops necessarily, that do provide income for the smallholder. And I think that's the next generation for us. As we think about the markets that we've approached and the way that we set up our rubric here, export cash crops were obviously the lead-in, and that's where the social lenders largely play. That was only 10% of the market for smallholders, and we said we're missing the 90%, and we've got to get after the 90%, so we need to understand at a much deeper and local level what is the relationship between the smallholder and the market outlet.
Three questions over here.
Ed Bresian from the World Bank. One of the aspects, getting back to your point initially, Robert, about policy, you know, whether it hinders or facilitates, Tom, you mentioned subsidy schemes, for example, in terms of possibly crowding out effective finance and maybe a business perspective as well. And I understand that getting into the policy discussion is unique for almost every country because context really does matter. But where has, if you can give a few examples, say, of technology policy, innovation policy, where it has facilitated or where it can be a facilitator in ag finance, or an access to inputs, whether it's machinery, seeds, other types, and perhaps where there are is a policy vacuum or where it's been a hindrance. Appreciate that. Thanks.
Before I joined Partner for Innovation in Deloitte, I was working with the government of the Philippines, and they were looking at how to incentivize inclusive business models, not just in agriculture, but more broadly. And one of the things that we identified as an issue was looking at trying to leverage tax amnesty as a way in which to incentivize companies to move down market. Because as many of us know, in emerging markets, the tax regimes are not well enforced, and most companies are not historically paying their taxes. So they owe a lot of money to the government and hope and pray that the government will never come knocking on their door and try to collect. So that's a big fear, and it's on their balance sheets in some way as sort of a big risk. If you can play with that from a policy perspective in terms of an investment model, they were quite open to rethinking and using tax amnesty, saying we'll forgive all of your previous debt to the government if you move more proactively in these kinds of business models, which makes sense for you because you can grow your business in these sort of customer segments or new market segments, and it helps create a more inclusive growth strategy for the country overall. That's one example that I thought was really interesting that I never thought that tax regimes would come into this conversation, but it was something that I thought was useful to share.
Yeah, and I'll leave it at that. One, and you're from the World Bank, so you probably know this, but for the broader group, there's actually a group that's coming out of the Doing Business Better part of the organization is going to be looking at policy regimes and doing some sort of data-based indication of who's doing it better, who's doing it worse, so you can actually understand a little bit more about the context going forward. And I'm certain that there will be technology indicators included in that data set.
A question from online.
Thank you. Tom did interpret that question correctly. He was looking for linking credit with buyer commitments. His next question comes from Jeannie Harvey, gender advisor at USAID. USAID has made a strong commitment to addressing the needs and special issues faced by women farmers. Do these models make any effort to specifically address the needs of women farmers, including the special constraints faced by them?
The models framework, there's a second layer of analysis that can look at many of these issues more specifically. And I was thinking of, you know, one day if we do a next generation and as we go online and create sort of broader inputs to thinking about these business models more succinctly, there are those kinds of challenges and issues that I think could be made much more explicit and more relevant. And I think the gender issue is definitely one. And I think having deeper dives on things like mechanization, the inputs market, you know, post-harvest and storage, training and extension, what are the models that work specifically in those contexts beyond just sort of the overarching general models that seem to work more broadly in the smallholder context. So I definitely think there is room for that, but we did not consider that lens for this part of our effort because it's sort of the first brick upon which we hope to lay the foundation for more thinking at a more refined level.
Another question from our in-person audience? All right. Pass it to Dan.
My name is Dan Silverstein. I'm an external private sector and capital markets advisor to MPI. I don't hear a lot of talk about the money markets, the credit markets, and the capital markets. And they, it would seem that they should play an essential role. There, as I was listening to your really excellent presentations, it popped into my head that it sounds a lot to me like it has the character of the Fuller Brush Man. You go from door to door, from farm gate to farm gate, basically, with a kit looking to provide services or to sell a product. In the industrialized nations, we've commoditized the money markets by facilitating short-term lending by corporations that have established credit ratings so that they can finance their receivables and do all kinds of short-term lending procedures. I don't see a lot of research about that. So my question is there research about this? Who's doing this? Is the World Bank looking at this? And is it feasible? Thanks.
So the short answer is yes. Are we good? But what I can say is, obviously that's a big question, because, you know, as we've tried to break apart the market, I can speak to one example where it's happening. So I mentioned the CSAF group, the Council for Smallholder Agricultural Finance and the Social Lenders. And one of the reasons they got together was to try and preempt what maybe happened in the microfinance industry 10, 15 years ago in terms of the ambiguity of how those services were provided and the impact they were having, standardized some processes for how they track their own businesses. And one of the main intentions for that was so that it would be easier for the capital providers, those funding their businesses, to know what good looked like and to know what they were getting into. There's another component of that for they themselves, which is the information that is being tracked has a lot to do with what donors require in their markets, not necessarily what, from an operational perspective, would ease their doing business, something like a credit bureau. And so that's kind of the next generation for them, which is thinking through what do we need the information to do in terms of our ability to make good loans and to attract capital to do so, and to give those who are funding us greater security that they're making good equity investments in our organizations.
I was thinking my question is somewhat of a corollary to the previous question about tax accounting. My question was a corollary to the previous question about tax accounting. It's all about
the institutionalization starting at the sovereign level down through the ranks in order to create this, to facilitate lending. And I just don't see a lot of that. But thanks for that.
Yeah, I mean, that's one aspect. One of the other part of this that we get into when it comes to sort of the next order of the capital markets, I mean, we talk about a lot with the direct farmers about local distribution. But some of what we're getting into are the financing vehicles that will allow the DFIs to get into this and the credit enhancement schemes. And so, yes, that is happening. Case in point, and maybe this goes further to answer your question, part of the project that we did for long-term debt, there was a peel-off piece of it that was a relationship between KFW, one of our steering committee members, and a global coffee organization. And what they wanted to do was set up a Mauritius-based fund with some credit enhancement involved, and then the coffee distributor would actually set up the local distribution and get further into the value chain. Not crowding out the local commercial capital, but reaching parts of it that they couldn't get to yet. And so it was expanding their own trade finance portfolio with KFW, and hopefully with other partners, in which case it would move to Luxembourg, would be able to provide a facility for them and a risk-adjusted facility to do so. That's happening.
And just to build on that, I did spend some time with ADB and IDB on inclusive business models and thinking about inclusive business strategy, specifically in the context of looking at some of those financing vehicles that go from the top to the bottom, as opposed to what we've discussed today, which is much more from the bottom to the top. And what I was surprised to learn that in the private sector portfolios of the larger banks, regional banks, there isn't a lot of agriculture. It kind of fell out of flavor for a good two decades. And now it's slowly coming back because there's a realization that infrastructure alone is not going to solve poverty in many of these countries. So there is some new thinking to say, well, can we use some of those facilities at sort of the meta level that can really sort of ease risk and provide those credit enhancements to different lending institutions to help them move down market, especially in the rural context. And there's some hope there. I think there is some new appreciation for those kinds of vehicles moving forward.
All right, well, we've reached the end of the hour, so we're going to go ahead and wrap up. So let's give our speakers one last round of applause. Thank you very much. And thank you all so much for joining. Thanks to our very large online audience. And if you have any further questions about Ag Sector Council or about the content of this particular event, please feel free to email me, Julie McCarty, jmccarty@usaid.gov. I'll either answer it or pass it along to the right person. And hope to see you at our November seminar. Thank you.